Good evening. Welcome to the Slayer Report. Today is Tuesday, May 10th, 2016. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I'm recording Money and Markets early this week because I'm flying out to Sydney, Australia tomorrow, and I won't arrive until Friday, so it's only Tuesday, but if you look at how much has happened since I recorded Money and Markets last Thursday, it's enough for two Money and Market shows. Events: Sunday brunch in Sydney this coming Sunday, May 15th. If you're down under, I hope you'll join us. Wonderful Sunday brunch. It's going to be a very good group. Small, but a great group. Our theme tonight is from a song. If you've ever seen the animated cartoon movie Prince of Egypt, the song is "You're Playing with the Big Boys Now." And it talks about what happens when you offend the powers that be and you go up against the really dirty players. So I want to start by telling you a story of Roger Stone that some of you have heard me tell before. Roger Stone is a political lobbyist, campaign manager, political operative. And when I worked in Washington as Assistant Secretary of Housing, I was approached by a reporter in the New York Times. They were doing big, so in the first section, page 16 stories on people who are one or two steps down in the agencies who are considered the real stars. So this reporter informed me that they wanted to do a story on me, and I said, well, you've got to clear it with the secretary's office, and the secretary's office wouldn't clear it. And the reporter came back to both the secretary's office and me and said, well, we're going to do the story anyway, you know, whether you help us or not. So it became kind of a tense situation, and what immediately started happening was the secretary's office kept dishing out negative stuff on me. And the reporter, who was a very, very amazingly capable investigative reporter who typically covered the Department of Justice and had done some very serious kind of investigations, was amazing in her ability to drive down and figure out what the facts were and what weren't, and was able to eventually sort of delete all of that, but said to me, you know, you've got real enemies in the secretary's office. And of course, I was trying to be politic and not admit that I knew that. But finally, she wrote the article, and I never read it, but my understanding was it was extremely complimentary, and it was supposed to publish, but it didn't. And a process began where she kept coming back to me saying, well, we have new evidence and it's really negative and I need to address this with you. Well, this went on for a week or two. It went on for a long time, and all of it was just complete lies. I mean, just complete lies. But I had to, you know, basically prove it again and again. And finally, she just said, you know, Roger Stone is feeding my editor, the Washington bureau chief, all of this stuff, and he's really got in for you. Now, Roger Stone at the time was at a firm named Black, Manafort & Stone. Paul Manafort was one of the partners. I think Lee Atwater was a partner there for a while. And the chief of staff to Kemp had come from Black, Manafort & Stone. The word was he had started at Black, Manafort & Stone as a driver in the campaigns, whether that's true or not. Anyway, but that was my first association with Roger Stone. What then happened was, so the reporter managed to edit it all out and soften how complimentary the story was and proceeded to go to publication, and then got a call from the print office that the Washington bureau chief was changing and inserting things behind her back without her knowledge, but with her byline. And the only way she could resolve the situation was to go to the New York editor and report the Washington bureau chief and pull the article and resign. So the article never ran. But that's when I first got a taste of, you know, playing with the big boys. So that was in 1989. We now see Roger Stone had started off as Trump's campaign manager, apparently, and then they disagreed on something. Stone dropped, but kept helping. The new campaign manager came in, and then when that campaign manager ran into trouble in Florida with saying that he'd abused a reporter, which I doubt was true, but it wouldn't surprise me if it was how somebody was getting Paul Manafort in there. But Paul Manafort then came in as a campaign advisor. Now, my understanding is Manafort has worked as an advisor to a whole series of Republicans, including George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, Dolan 96. And in fact, my firm, Hamilton, got attacked right in the spring of 1996. I was told in April of 1996 that, quote, the big boys have gotten together and, you know, you're going to be framed and you're going to jail, you're going down. And I'll never forget when I was told that. I said, Scott, I'm too clean. You can't, you know, you're never going to get me. He said, no, you don't understand. The fix is in, you're going down. Now, it was just at that moment that money poured in from a whole world of donors into the Dole campaign. And then we got hit with a phony baloney frame and phony baloney litigation simultaneously. And it wouldn't surprise me, going back to the Worker trilogy, if it was the real estate and construction and investment interests behind the syndicate that I think was doing prisons and global rendition centers and sort of financing and make money on the war on terrorism, because we were going the opposite direction in terms of taking entrepreneurial opportunity into low-income neighborhoods as opposed to rounding people up and throwing them in essentially federal prisons where they could be marketed on a for-profit basis by the Department of Justice to the military to make uniforms. So there was a real push underway, and it wouldn't surprise me if it was the investors in what I refer to as the Gladstone Group. That's the name from the Worker trilogy, which was movie of the year in as of for 2015 in January. If you haven't seen it, it's a great view on the world. Okay, so to bring it back, Manafort was present, and we got hit with this incredible frame of phony baloney smears and lies, and it took 11 years to disprove all of it. But one of the things you need to understand is when you fight with all the money in the planet, it doesn't matter. Facts don't matter, evidence doesn't matter. They just keep throwing the mud, and they throw it at you with confidence. You know, I've told the story many times about my chief financial officer coming to see me and saying, you know, I got up this morning and I said, well, maybe she is laundering money. And then I realized, wait a minute, I wrote all the checks. So, and it takes two signatures on every check. So she can't launder money unless I launder money. And I know I'm not laundering money. And he looked at me and he said, how could I even think that? It's very, you know, it's very upside down when the media hits you with that force. Anyway, so let's talk about what we saw after the Indiana primary. We saw Ted Cruz, who said he was going to go all the way and fight through the convention, get hit by Trump bringing up his dad's association with a group around the Kennedy assassination, and then a Trump ally floating a story in the National Enquirer about extramarital affairs, and boom, 24-hour later, Cruz drops out of the race, and then Kasich, boom, drops out of the race. It reminds you very much of Christie after Christie came out and announced his endorsement of Trump, and the look on his face, his whole body, his whole spirit was like he'd been hit by a truck. So whether it's Cruz, Kasich, or Christie, all three looked like they'd been hit by a truck, and you could just play along the tune. You're playing with the big boys now, because Trump is not afraid to take into the mainstream press things that the establishment never brings up. You know, people who live in glass houses don't throw stones, and so you don't see these kinds of allegations. Interestingly enough, coming into the campaign, Roger Stone wrote a book outing the Clintons and outing the Bushes with a lot of the vetted dirt that's never really been vetted in the mainstream. And we saw after Indiana a Trump spokesperson come on Fox News and say to the moderator, you know, Clinton's never been vetted. The moderator almost fell off her chair and said, what do you mean Clinton's never been vetted? You know, Clinton's been the First Lady, Secretary of State, a senator. She's totally vetted. And the Trump spokesperson said, no, she's never been vetted, which means she's never been vetted for the real deal dirt, because the understanding within the establishment is, you know, we're not gonna go at each other with razor blades, because everybody's involved in this. You know, the organized crime model in the national security state is a model that everybody more or less participates in, and so nobody can afford to illuminate the model. So the clear indication you're getting from the Trump camp, with the presence of Roger Stone and Paul Manafort, and with what Trump's been doing, is they're planning on pulling out the real model dirt, which is going to blow up a lot more than just the Clinton campaign. It's going to blow up the whole model, or it could. And you almost get the sense that Trump is ready to cut into, you know, let's go to fascism, do not collect $200, do not pass go. You know, you don't need the patina on the front. Somebody said to me this week, I guess all the guys in the underground bases are going to come upstairs once Trump is president. Why am I saying all of this? What I'm saying is that with Roger Stone and Paul Manafort combined working with Trump, we are going to see people who would not be doing this unless they have significant support. So the question is, where is the support coming from? Is it coming from the intelligence agencies or a subsection thereof, the military, a subsection thereof, the banks? The banks and Trump are very close, so a subsection thereof. Just think of anybody who was involved in laundering money legally behind national security law through New Jersey casinos, et cetera, or big New York real estate. So who knows? We don't know yet. And I think this campaign is very fluid, and the power struggles going on are very fluid, because we're coming into the end game. And that means that there is a lot to be gathered by grabbing the prize. Now, we have also seen today the West Virginia primary, and on the Democratic side, a Nebraska primary. Now, that might be the Republican. But what we've seen is Sanders beat Clinton by a lot in West Virginia. Now, Clinton has the superdelegates, which is where her strength comes from, but that's not coming from the electorate. And if you look at how weak her showing is up against Sanders in these last few primaries, it's very bad. And Sanders is intent on continuing to go down the track. Now, the game that we've been watching and that I alluded to in the 90s, when you saw huge money pour into the Dolan-Clinton campaign. For years, we've been going through centralization of the economy. There's a giant sucking sound from the general economy up into corporations, whether it's government money, whether it's sucking up market share from small business. And there's a vicious cycle going on. You suck the market share into the big companies who have higher PEs, and then that generates capital gains, and they use that capital gains to pay campaign contributions. If you look at the story I wrote, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, one of my goals with that story was to give you a really good case study on the relationship between engineering capital gains on publicly traded stocks and then that engineering money back to the politicians, and around we go. We saw that game this week with e-cigarettes. You've had the FDA comes out with regulations that basically are designed, among other things, to completely shift that market out of small dynamic businesses into the large companies, and in fact delay that market from its growth, and so protecting the large tobacco companies as well. So don't think that that isn't going to take that whole market that's not generating a lot of campaign contributions and convert it into something that's going to create pop on big publicly traded stocks, and that's going to generate a lot of political campaign donations during the election, is my expectation. So it's the dance of centralization, and frankly, it's destroying the economy, because we now have centralization for the sake of keeping the game going without regard to the extraordinary subsidy that needs to be provided by government debt as that dance suboptimizes and shrinks the total pie. Okay, money in markets, as the debt growth model slows, musical chairs all over the place, including on the dance of centralization. So it's really time to batten down the hatches. It's one of the reasons, as I said last week, that we published the sort of report on cash management for you. I think that will help you batten down the hatches with respect to cash. The equity markets were off to a great week. They've had a very nice few days, despite how bad things look, but I'm very much in batten down the hatches mode. The Puerto Rico debt crisis continues, with the island saying more payments aren't going to be made. They have about $70 billion of U.S. dollar outstanding debt, and that's not a high debt to GDP ratio, although their GDP is falling. The problem is it's in a currency they can't print. And as I said, you know, when you look at the debt numbers of countries that have high debt but can print the currency that they're borrowing in, it's a very, very different picture than a country that is borrowing in a currency it doesn't control. So one of the headaches is sovereign and municipal debt, and Puerto Rico is the latest example. Another great example, the Treasury Department rejected a plan by the Teamsters to cut their pension benefits. They wanted to cut it in half now as opposed to just running out for the next 10 years and then hitting a wall and going to zero on everybody. But Treasury declined their plan. Again, as we discussed with Don Cox, a lot of the challenges on the pension funds, state, local, corporate, union, everything across the board, is going to be delayed until after the election. But Don Cox says that's going to be the number one issue. And given the drop in yields and what that's doing, the pension funds and the insurance companies, I agree with him. It's going to be the number one issue, even if it's not in the media. It'll be affecting that many people. China debt and market bubbles. There's a great spread in the latest Economist, and I've sent in some of the links to the, we'll post some of the links on the website. But there is a real concern that China, to keep its sort of bubbles going, has really taken its debt up in extraordinary manner since 2008. And what could happen if those bubbles burst. Saudi Arabia is facing life after oil. It's a similar problem to many of the commodities, particularly in fossil fuel. But the U.S. is nearing energy self-sufficiency, and fracking and renewable efficiencies are growing everywhere. And so that's a big change for Saudi Arabia. We a while back, they went out for $4 billion of bonds, but you can see their cash flows are getting really pinched, not as badly as Venezuela, that has now severe food shortages. We see a new article this week that the Venezuelan soldiers in the Venezuelan army were arrested for stealing goats. They were stealing the goats so they could eat them since there was no food in the barracks. That's not a good sign. A very interesting study out from McKinsey Global Institute, I referred to it earlier, but I want to stress it. I think it's very much worth your time. We posted a link on the website. Saying investors need to anticipate sort of reduced expectations of yields. And one of the things it looks at is the return on fixed income versus equity in a variety of different scenarios. And what it basically says is you got to stay invested in equities because there's no yield anyplace else. I think it's one of the things that's been supporting the equity markets. I'm very concerned about doing that in the domestic markets where the PE is high, and it's one of the reasons that I keep doing more and more with hedged equity, because you want to stay in and get that dividend, but you don't want to take the big, you know, a big down. Going to a bear market, you could take a 50% down. That's a big down to take after you lived through 2008 for many people. But interestingly enough, Wall Street Journal had a story today saying, let me read you the beginning. The humble dividend is reclaiming its rightful place as the arbiter of stock market value, and three of the four biggest developed market shares offer a higher yield than the longest dated government bond. And in the fourth, the U.S., the dividend yield beats even a 20-year bond. So I think that's part of what's levitating the market. And one of the things the article points out is that's not necessarily a good news if you look at the fact that the market, relative to a lot of markets around the world, have a lot less expectation of gains over time. If we were going to get, it's really funny, if we were going to get into a spaceship and leave for 20 years and not be back, we wouldn't necessarily want to keep our money in the domestic markets. We might want to put it in the emerging markets. But given the uncertainty in the next couple of years, it's hard to have the discipline to want to put it there now. Creative destruction in finance. I'm going to be talking about this more this year. I'm reading a lot, thinking a lot about it. You keep seeing the word fintech, and you keep seeing articles about blockchain technology. I think it's important to understand what fintech is. It's basically taking digital technology and using it to re-engineer an unending number of financial services. But fintech is here. It's interesting the way the financial services industry really delayed it, including with the housing bubble and the various bubbles. But that's over. And now fintech is upon us. The other one, which I think is very important, is blockchain technology. There are more and more institutions and central banks trying to figure out how they can use blockchain technology to basically do open source ledgers for settlement. And although I think this is going to take a while, it really does have tremendous potential to re-engineer how the financial systems work. So I would just encourage you throughout this year to take an effort to write down those two words, fintech and blockchain, and say, you know, I'm going to learn more about that. Okay, let's take a look at the markets. The U.S. dollar index came up a little bit. It's about 94.27, but it's still down 4.5% for the year. Bonds doing very well. The 20-year Treasury ETF right now up 9.4%. The bond aggregate ETF up 3.67%. That compares to the S&P of 2.77%. So I can't believe it. The bond aggregate's outperforming the S&P, but what can you say? With S&P dividends, actually, that may be much closer. I'm just giving you the gain for the year. The junk market is doing surprisingly well, and part of it is the oil recovery has brought it up. It's up 5.3% for the year. I would be very careful about that. Germany is now in the black, up 0.38%. The developed markets, minus North America, still down 1% for the year. The emerging markets now up only 2.61%, so they've given up a lot of their gains for the year. China down 8.5%. I think the debt is really weighing on those markets. India now down, I'm using one of the India funds, down 1.48%. Real estate skyrocketing. Now, some of it is people want the dividends, but I'm beginning to worry that Trump is having an impact. It's not a good sign. It's basically saying, I say whatever I want to get elected, and then it's a party for me and my pals. But U.S. commercial real estate is up 8.25% for the year. That's the IYR ETF, and that compares to the S&P at 2.77. So basically 300% so far this year of what the S&P is doing. Oil now down 6%. That sounds bad, but it's a relief compared to where we were at one point earlier this year. Gold coming back down. It's now up 19.24%. Silver up 23.43%. Again, those are the top performers for the quarter. It looks attractive. I'm very suspicious. And it's a very uncomfortable situation because we're looking at the primary trend on the dollar, the primary trend on equities, the primary trend on bonds, the primary trend on precious metals, and all of them are in question. And that makes things very nerve-wracking. If you're a trend follower, all you can do is sort of sit on the corner and fret. Okay, our hero this week is Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey. I think one of the reasons Dorsey gets such bad press is he does stuff like this. Twitter has barred the intelligence agencies from using the analytics survey that it uses as a partner. It's a company, Data Miner, and that provides access to do multiple analytics on what people are saying and doing on Twitter. And so now they're cutting the intelligence agencies out. This is a good sign, but expect Dorsey to take more bad press. Ask Catherine, which is getting a lot of questions. First of all, thanks for the great links. Keep them coming. Hi, Catherine. Someday I would love to hear more about your True Life Minority Report story. If you went into it in one of the archives and I missed it, please direct me to the episode. If you go to the Dylan Reed story at dunwalkie.com in the resource section, there's a whole section on Hamilton Securities. It's at dunwalkie.com/Gideon. It goes into, there are literally tens of thousands of pages of legal documents and more than you would want to ever know. It's all there. And I did do one interview with John Rappaport on the Hamilton Securities story. So you can find that in the archives and in the group in the library that has all the Rappaport. The writer of this question then goes on to talk about some very strange events that happened to them on the border. I think what you're dealing with is what I call the data beast, which is the relational database technology with artificial intelligence that's used by the intelligence agencies. And it's much more powerful and aggregated than I think people understand. And my guess is you were having some back and forth with the With the Data Beast, one great subscriber wrote in this week and was complaining that they traded one phone call with someone they were doing construction work with, and the next thing you know, that person showed up on their Facebook page as somebody you might want to connect with. He said, from one phone call. He says, anytime he buys things, he, you know, suddenly those things pop up on all the website ads. And sure enough, you know, you're being harvested by the Data Beast. As Nicholas Negroponte said, in a digital age, data about money is worth more than money. Okay, Catherine, what is your view on getting involved in currency trading? Are there any big things to watch out for? I would avoid currency trading. I just think it's a highly managed business by players who have enormous amounts of money to swing around. So you're really playing in the middle of a big boy war, and I think it's extremely difficult to make money. If you insist on doing it, it's very important to run it sort of like a Swiss watch and constantly try and play from your winnings. You have to be very disciplined. Start small. If you make money, you just start playing from your winnings, and always put aside, you know, think of this as like a tithing system. Always skim off a piece of the profits. First pay off your principal, and then create a reserve pool and then a pool to trade, and just be playing with your winnings and do it in a very disciplined way. It means you're slow to build a pool and slow to really build profits. But to me, it's the only way to manage things in that market. But I for one think that if you have the talent and the discipline to do that, you can make a lot more money elsewhere. Let's see. Someone sent us a below article about a digital cash system unveiling. Can you discuss what you know about this for the company reference called Chain? Yeah, it's a blockchain technology company, and I think the article truly, my guess is, completely misrepresented what really went on. I think what happened is you have a company that's doing blockchain, and it's trying to educate and interest everyone into using it. And so what it did is it had the equivalent of a roadshow. We used to call it a roadshow. Roadshow is what you do when you're marketing an offering, but they had a roadshow for the technology, and it was an invitation only, and they're trying to teach everybody about it and help them think about how they can use it. So I think it's a little bit more, sort of the normal course of business than this wild secret meeting that's being portrayed. But I do think there's tremendous interest in the central banks and the banks for blockchain technology. And I thank you for sending this, because I think it's very important that we take the time to learn about this technology, because I do think it's going to make a big impact. Catherine, what is your view? Wait, next one. Hello, Catherine. I've recently been getting up to speed about the work that Dr. Joel Wallach, in addition, one of his proteges, pharmacist Ben Fuchs, are doing in the area of health and healing. Dr. Wallach has been around for some time and has astounding information about how to heal in a surprisingly simple way just about every illness there is. He's the founder of the Longevity Company, a multi-level marketing company which has been extremely successful in its own right. I'm guessing you have heard of Dr. Wallach. He's best known for a talk he does in a book by the title called Dead Doctors Don't Lie. I don't know of him, but I did order the book, and so I will say this. If you guys want me to read a book, it would help me if you just send me the book. I can't buy 40 books a month, let alone read them. Anyway, so she wrote much more about Dr. Wallach, but let the book come in, and I'll take a look at it after I get back from Australia, and we'll see what we see. Somebody sent more on the Kennedy assassination, inspired by our conversation with David Talbot. If you have not listened to that interview, please do. It's a life, that book and that interview is a life-changing view of the world. It's fantastic. Anyway, they had asked me why I thought Kennedy was killed in such a public way. I said I thought it was a ritual killing. And they wrote back and asked what I thought. The June 29th, the 1963 event that took place in the Vatican that Father Malachi wrote about is somehow tied into the November Dallas event, in my opinion. So the question was, did the Vatican approve the hit on Kennedy or not? Hello, Catherine. Do you know anything about this man and his most recent article? Here's the link, neilkeenan.com. Okay, this is a website about the a dragon family from Asia and the Dinar. And basically, it's what I call an adult fairy tale. So I would not use your time on that. I did an interview with Dark Journalist about adult fairy tales in COINTELPRO, and you might want to listen to that. But I would basically avoid websites like that. I just don't think it's a good use of your time. And then they said, I would be greatly honored if you would consider adding our small church in its CD cell, Carmen, I'm going to mispronounce this, Campiche, to your daily prayers. I will do that. And it's in Mexico. Looks wonderful. They sent the link. And so we're going to make a small donation and put the link up on the website. And I would encourage anyone who would like to help what looks to be a wonderful church in Mexico and what looks to be a great ministry. If you're interested in supporting that, check that out. We'll have it up on the blog by on the website by tomorrow afternoon. Okay, let's go to the movies. I wanted to revisit one that we've had before. Occasionally I'll do this when I think a documentary or movie is really unique in its ability to communicate to you how the system works. I'm always trying to give you pieces, and examples and case studies that will help you really see the game. Again, I'm trying to build your immune system and vastly increase your powers to duck when it's time to duck. And so I'm trying to help you see the game. And this one does a great job. It's called Shut Up and Sing. And it's the story of the unsuccessful effort to intimidate and censor the Dixie Chicks singing group, who at the time was the number one female group in the country. The lead singer at a concert in London on the same day as a big demonstration against the Iraq War made a comment that they were embarrassed that the president was from Texas. And boy, did it unleash a you-know-what storm. It was incredible. If you want to see the whole national security state come down, and big use of entrainment. They really tried to waste these three women. And this is an important story because freedom of artistic expression is absolutely essential to free speech. And that is absolutely essential to a free society. And it's why the global political system invests a great deal of time and money trying to get popular artists and celebrities to toe the line. And when artists like the Dixie Chicks, stand their ground, it takes incredible, incredible courage. And in this case, it took incredible teamwork because the all three stood behind the or stood together, and the two other band members backed the lead singer, and they held together as a group. It's a remarkable story, and the documentary takes you through the whole event, and then the sort of the smear campaign, the business problems they had to live through, and their next album, and how they came back. It's amazing and very inspiring. And then our interview was inspired what happened with the censorship of Vaxxed, the documentary about vaccines at the Tribeca Film Festival. For 2 weeks running, I think Robert De Niro has been the hero. He was the co-founder of Tribeca and, of course, the great luminary in and around the Tribeca Film Festival. And what was amazing is the way that he handled it got far more publicity for Vax than the Tribeca, it running a Tribeca ever could have. I mean, he's done a marvelous job. And his interviews were so effective because he said, look, we need to watch these documentaries. We need to figure out what's going on. We need to get to the truth. Let's just have an open conversation. And the way he did it was really masterful. I have to give him credit. Anyway, when I watched the latest interview that we put up on the website with De Niro talking about Vaxxed, I called Rappaport and I said, you and I have got to do a Saleery report on the great stories of suppression. All these stories of where amazing technology, amazing knowledge has been, unbelievably suppressed, and then the heroes who won't let it happen. And if you look at many of Rappaport's writings over the last 2 decades, he's done a remarkable job of really promoting and highlighting the stories of these heroes who just outwit suppression. It's quite remarkable. Anyway, so John and I picked a whole series of very famous stories. It's more U.S. centric, and it really tells you a lot about how things are. It was amazing when I finally made my list. It was so long, and I called John and I said, "You know, when the official reality is this separate from reality, everything is about suppression." And anyway, so it was a conversation I really enjoyed having, and John is so superb on this. So consider Shut Up and Sing a great case study in one of these suppression stories in a documentary. Very well done. I have not yet seen Vaxxed, but I have reports from numerous subscribers who have seen it. It's traveling around the country. They're trying to do as many theaters as possible before they, you know, they go to the Netflix, Amazon, and online route. And the feedback I get is uniformly excellent about both Vaxxed and the one that we're going to recommend in June when we do our, when we publish our great interview with Dr. Laura Thompson, called Trace Amounts, which I did a review of, and it's up on the website. And that's another one I encourage you to watch. Okay, closing. Coming up next week, unbelievable interview with Helen Chaitman, lead attorney for the Madoff victims. She has a new book called J.P. Madoff, and she pulls the carpet up, and we look down at the real deal on J.P. Morgan's relationship with Madoff. It's unbelievable, just unbelievable. She has, her book is J.P. Madoff. She's got a great website, J.P. Madoff. She was a very successful attorney, a brilliant woman, very clear, very coherent, and she has just done yeoman's work helping the victims and nailing the story. So you will find that fascinating. May 19th, J.P. Madoff with Helen Chaitman. Then on May 26th, Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin. I'm sure you're going to hear Franklin tell us that it's bottomed and me say, no, I don't think so. So that'll be interesting. But certainly Precious Metals has had a glorious first quarter, and boy, wouldn't it be great if the primary trend reasserted. Nobody would love that more than me, although I think Franklin would love it a lot. And then a very special treat on June 2nd. I am looking forward to this. The, in my opinion, the top food expert in the world, Harry Blaser, the founder of Harry's Farmers Market in Atlanta, sold to Whole Foods in 2000, and then since then, one of the top food consultants all over the world. And this is the man who taught me everything I know about food. Unbelievable, unbelievable intellect and entrepreneur. We're going to be talking about how to build a great food system in your neighborhood, and nobody has unpacked it or dug down at it more than Harry Blaser. He's really, but he has his, until now, his work has been very much with large corporations, but Harry has finally agreed he's gonna go retail and talk to all of us. So that's gonna be June 2nd. So it's a great lineup. Helen Chaitman, J.P. Madoff next week, Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders, and then How to Build a Great Food System in Your Neighborhood with Harry Blaser. So, and ladies and gentlemen, until May 19th, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Good night and good luck.